Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Murphy Deacon Sr. Today I'm talking to Anne Marie Morelli, who is a wheelchair user, actor, and director. Anne Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Keith. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. I'm glad that you're here and to know you. You acted opposite me in my first production with Theatre Breaking Through Barriers in 2019.
That's so great. Yes. Yes, I remember.
Yet, I don't remember the title, but I believe it was written by Nico, I'm terrible with last
Nico name. Grelli.
Nico Grelli. Grelli. I played the son of either a Italian or Irish mob boss, and you played the opposite. Scared the dickens out of me by how good you were. You made me bring my A++ game. It was a wonderful experience.
It was fun, yes. It was great.
And then the whole world changed the very next year.
Yeah.
So I interviewed a man you know quite well last year, Nicholas Vecelli. Who I can't even speak without laughing so much. Who is, of course, the autistic, autistic director of Theater Breaking Through Barriers. And I just interviewed Richard M. Rhodes, who is a Shakespearean actor, who is also a director and actor, who actually knows both you and Nick a very long time.
Forever.
Start there, because your episode completes the trilogy and I want to connect the dots for the listener.
Okay. Well, Nick Vecelli is my husband. We have been together, I think, since I was born. We were together.
Wow. Well, do tell me more about that.
Nick and I, actually, it's funny. I have been with Nick, honestly, since I've been in high school.
Respect.
Yeah.
You don't hear about those types of couples anymore.
Yeah. Respect. We met back home. We're both from Scranton, Pennsylvania. You know, the two of us and Joe Biden. And, because I don't know how else to do that. And we met doing community theater back in Scranton during a production of MAME. And so we've been together forever. Richard, and this I find interesting, Nick has known Richard longer than he's known me. I have not known Richard as long as Nick, but I guess Nick and Richard at one point in his many lives and his many, many places of living, lived in Scranton. Yeah. He lived in Scranton for a while, and they also met doing community theater back in Scranton. They did a production of 1776 together before I met Nick, and years before I met Richard. Yeah, and then to close the trilogy here, Nick and I both worked at the New Jersey Shakespeare Festival back in the late 80s, and Richard was in charge of the interns of the New Jersey Shakespeare Festival at that time during another course of his life when he was living in Jersey. And I don't know where else he lived in between. I know he lived in Maine at some point, in between all that. And yeah, so we that's where I met Richard, but that's where Nick and Richard hooked up again. Yeah, so I've known Richard since 1980. 8 or 89 or something like that. I've known Nick since 85, and I've known Richard since I think it's 89 is when I first met Richard. So yeah, we've known each other all a really long time.
Yeah, and that's where the trilogy comes in because I've talked about the exact same thing with both Nick and Richard. It's very interesting to hear of a trilogy of people who have known each other in various different ways and capacities in lives, if I may follow that. And so that is why I wanted to complete the trilogy. So let's dive in a bit more. You have known Nick Vercelli since high school. Do you remember your first impression of him back in high school?
Well, that's where we digress, Nick and I. Because according to me, I met him in 1985 doing MAME. According to him, I met him the year before, because he came to a show I was in with another mutual friend of ours, and I ignored him. Because I was so happy to see my friend, and he introduced me. Supposedly, Nick says he introduced me to him, and I went, "Oh, hi," and then just totally ignored him after that. To me, we met the following year, and I just had a crush on him from the second I started working with him.
Wow. Yeah. All great love stories start there, ladies and gentlemen. So, what happened next?
Well, Nick was in college, and I mean, for God's sake, I was a. I think I don't. 85, I graduated. Yeah, I was going into my senior year of high school. Well, it was the summer before my senior year of high school. So he went back to college, and I went to school. And we kept in touch, and we actually started dating like later that year. Oddly, he would just come in on weekends or whatever. In when he graduated from college, he moved to New York briefly, and then we got into the Shakespeare Festival, both of us, and so he stopped living here for all for like a. He didn't live here again. I think he moved back to New York. That so he moved here. He lived here in 88. But then we got into the Shakespeare Festivals 2 years in a row. We were asked back the second year. And so he moved back to Scranton. But after our second year at the festival, there was a a show going on, and they needed people to help out. At that point, I was big into I really loved lighting and stuff, and they needed people hanging lights or focusing lights and stuff, and they just needed people to help this production that was going up, and it was can't remember the name of it. It was the J. It was like the Jewish theater, the American Jewish theater. I can't remember what the name of it was. Nick, I'm sure, knew, because we went just this one day to help them set up everything, and they really liked Nick, and they asked him to be like an assistant stage manager, and he ended up going on tour with this group. Oh gosh, right. Oh, it was called, was it called Those Were the Days? It was a review. It was really interesting. And he ended up going on tour with this company, which he was supposed to be the lead in my senior production in college. And the tour he was on kept getting extended. And I was like, "You're gonna kill me. I'm never gonna graduate. I can't do my show without you. I need to." But he made it back in time to do my show. But it was funny. And yeah, so then I graduated. I'm sorry, it was 90 and 91. It had to be the Shakespeare, or maybe, I don't know, 89, 90, and 90, 91. But because I didn't graduate college until 91. And the reason I graduated late is because I took time off to be an intern at the Shakespeare Festival while I was in college, which is the smartest thing I ever did. Yeah,
Why?
so then, I mean, because I met a lot of people, and it was great. Actually, the Shakespeare Festival is, it's funny because when you're there, all you do is complain about how much work it is, and then when it's over, you're like, wow, that was the best time of my life, kind of thing. I was understudying the role of Isabella in Measure for Measure, and as an intern, you're like, yeah, I'm okay. We'll have a performance later in the season, but it was like the first or second week that it went up. I mean, it was in repertory, but the first or second week that it went up, the actress playing Isabella ended up in the hospital. And I had to go on for 2 weeks. I went on, and I didn't know the show. I knew like a speech or two because I was too busy being an intern, which means I was too busy cleaning toilets and making props and doing stuff like that. And then every night, because we were in repertory, we had to switch the set over for the next show. But one of the actors in the show, great, he's my hero to this day. His name is T. Rider Smith. He was playing, I'll tell him yet, but Angelo. He was playing Angelo in the show. And he stayed with me the entire day. He was like, at that point, I wasn't in Equity. I wasn't in the Actors Union yet. It was, so you earned points back then. I don't even know if they do that anymore. I don't think so. Equity membership credits, and you got them during the Shakespeare Festival. But anyway, that one of the Equity actors, T, he stayed with me all day, and I learned that show the day before the night I went on. And I don't have any recollection of doing the show. I it's like this weird, I just remember going off stage and people pushing me to where I should go, where I enter next. But I got a review and I got a good review, so hey, it was fun. Anne-Marie Morelli, understudy, played Isabella oh God, what did they say? Grace and something. I don't know. Something Grace. And I was like, oh, okay, that was nice.
And it was at that point you, several years prior, you met Richard M. Rhodes. What was your first impression of him?
Oh, I Richard, if you know Richard, I know you know Richard. You can't. There is no way you can't love him. He is just, he's amazing. He is such a sweetheart. He's, everything about him is just joy. It's a joyous experience to be around Richard. And it was great because our second year, I guess the theater wasn't up to code. So the three of us,
Okay.
it was Richard, Nick, and me. We spent the entire season basically rewiring the theater, which was great because it was the three of us together all the time. So it was great. Yeah, I love Richard Rose. I mean, he's so smart. That man is a genius. He reads stage. He reads like stereo directions for fun. He's one of the
Yes,
and
he
gets
very
it, you know.
much is that.
But he's a
So,
great actor. He's an amazing director. He knows Shakespeare back and forth and up and down and every which way. He's a musician. I mean, he's just, you know, he's a man of many, many talents.
if I may ask, what is it like doing Shakespeare in a wheelchair, which shouldn't matter, it's Shakespeare, but there's a physicality and there's a lot of action in every Shakespeare production.
Well, all right. I wasn't in a wheelchair when I worked at the Shakespeare Festival. I always say I let my claim to fame with TBTB is I'm the one person who became disabled when they who became disabled during their tenure at TBTB. In nineteen it was not I mean it was 1988. I mean, so it was before, it was like during my tenure. I did have my I have a multiple sclerosis. So my first episode, or my, you know, whatever you want to call it, was optic neuritis. And what that is, I actually lost the central vision in my left eye. And that kind of went on for about a year. I went, you know, but the thing is, nobody knew what was wrong. I went to my regular eye doctor. She didn't know. She sent me to a different ophthalmologist. I don't know that they didn't know, but they just kept sending me places for tests and tests. So by the time I actually, you know, after doing all the tests for my eyes, by the time they came up with what it was, it had already started to get better. So there really wasn't anything they could do, because it was like a year of testing and testing. And when I went, I had an MRI, which back in the day it was so long. It's not that long anymore. But I went for an MRI, and then I was down at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, and they were doing a, I'm not sure, I can't remember what the test is called. An EEG or something. They had all these electrodes stuck to my head. And then they were flashing pictures or something.
Yeah,
And
that would be EEG or EKG, but I
no,
think
EKG is your heart. This is like an electro.
so yeah, it's
Yeah.
EEG.
Right. So I was, you know, I was going through that test, and in bad form. Totally bad form. The nurse kind of let it slip that she thought it was MS, which is not her. Actually, it wasn't the nurse, it was the person running the test, so I don't even know what they were.
The tech.
Yeah, the tech kind of let it loose. Just here's a weird flashback, and everybody, this freaks everybody out. When I was a little kid, I was probably like 7 or 8. I was probably 8. I was all excited. I got mail. And I was like, oh my God, I got a letter. You know, it was a big deal. And it was from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. And at the time, back, especially back in Scranton, I don't know, I'm sure if it was everywhere, but muscular dystrophy was all, you know, doing their, always had their telethon and Jerry Lewis and blah, blah, blah. And I got this letter and they were asking for money. And I was like, I'm like a kid. I'm a little kid. But I was a nerdy kid. So I went to the library and I learned about multiple sclerosis. At the time it was called the Crippler of Young Adults. It's not called that anymore, but it was. And I learned all about it and I went door to door and started collecting money for MS. I was like, everybody collects for MD. I'm going to collect for MS. And then, you know, 12 years later, guess what? I'm like, this is wrong. This is just wrong. I gave you money. I gave you money already. Why are you doing this to me? So
I'm not laughing. It's just the shock, the foreshadowing is real. It's oh wow.
Yeah. So all right, so then 88, and then I was fine. I didn't have, you know, after my eye cleared back, and it honestly it's been good ever since. In 1992, I went to London to study at the National Theater. It was an American actors program at the National Theater in London. And when I was there, I remember calling Nick from London, and it was when Doc Martens first came out. They were like a really big deal, and I just was like, yeah, I love these shoes so much. I said, but man, they're heavy, because I'm just like dragging, you know, at night I'm just dragging my feet. And it turns out it was another episode, and they still hadn't technically diagnosed me, because they said at that time you needed 3 episodes before they would give you an official diagnosis.
Well, lucky number 3.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had many before then, before I got diagnosed. Then in 92, I moved to New York. And then again, the following year, we were invited, Nick, and because Nick had gone to London the year before me. And then I went to London the year after. And then we both got invited back for another program the following year. And I was good. I was good then. But then when I got back to New York, I really started having trouble walking. Like my one leg would just, it was like lead. My right leg, I just couldn't pick it up. And I didn't see... And the thing was, Nick was like, you know, we got to get you to a doctor. And I was like, no, because I know what it is. And as long as they don't tell me, I don't have it. I was like, so I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't go to a doctor. I finally went in 95. I went to see a neurologist and he, of course, said, yeah, I have MS. And I said, see, I told you, if I didn't go, I wouldn't know. But if they don't say it, I don't have it.
Yeah, so how was, once you got the official diagnosis, but always knew in the back of your mind, but once you got the official diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
How was it adapting to the elephant in the room, per se, that was always there, and that there's no escaping me now?
Right.
The diagnosis could talk. That's only what it would say until, if you don't mind, talk about
No, not at all.
that journey.
Yeah, I was pretty good. I would have, I would have lapses. So I would have, at one time I lost the feeling in my hands. That actually never came back completely. It's mostly there, but it never came back completely. And I, the trouble with the drop foot and that, I went numb from the waist down, but that didn't last. That only lasted a few days. In 1995, I believe they came out with the first ABC drug for MS, and they called them the ABC drugs because it was, what was the first one? The first one was Betaseron, the second one was Avonex, and the third one was Copaxone. That's why they're the ABC drugs, which doesn't make sense because it went BAC, but okay. I never was on Betaseron, but in 1998, yeah, I started with Avonex, which was an intramuscular injection that was supposed to slow the progression. But it really didn't do much for me. And I was on that for a few years, and then they came out with another one, which was called Rebif. And that I did for many years. And that one wasn't intramuscular, it was subcutaneous. And I was on Rebif for 10 or 12 years. And that, self-injections every couple of days. But yeah, I mean, I thought I was pretty good. I did, I started, I had a cane that I never used. I do believe in my first production with TBTB. I don't know that I used it, but I had it just in case I needed it, kind of thing. But I don't think I ever used it in the production. And then by 2006, I think, I started really slowing down, like walking wise. It would take me a really long time to walk a block. It would be like a half an hour. And then by 2007, I was in a wheelchair. I could still walk. I could still get out of it and like walk around the apartment or whatever, or walk, I could do small distances, but I couldn't do a long distance. I was working in a hotel, and Nick would literally ride me to work, and then I would get out and go to work. Like I didn't need it once I was there, but I couldn't walk any long distances at all.
Hold on, let me process all of this timeline. Hold on. So, where were we in terms of you had a cane you never really used, and you were talking about after Nick drove you to walk?
Yeah. Well, Nick, before that, Nick was like my human cane.
I'm
So,
sure he appreciated
yeah, it's just everywhere we went, I was always like hanging on to him. And it was like, oh, they're so much in love. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's really because I can't do it without him.
So if I may ask, are you two married or engaged at that time?
At that, we got married in 1997.
Okay, so this
No, I
is.
am lying. I am totally lying to you. Met in 85, 95. We got married in 1996. I'm like, I wait, I'm totally lying to you.
No, I feel Good that you said that, kids. I'm having trouble keeping up with the timelines of
Right.
everything. So you're diagnosed it, and where
Not
we are is way past
well,
in.
95 was the official diagnosis.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
Yeah, 95, I got the official word. 96, we got married. And if I here, I'll even screw you up even more, because in
Please
1988,
do.
yeah, in 1988, we're going back, which is when I had my optic neuritis. But we got cast in a production of Julius Caesar. And again, it was back home. It was in Scranton, but it was at the University of Scranton with Richard Harris. And we met this guy, this actor who was wonderful. He's a blind actor from New York City named George Achiotis, who said, we got very close with George. He was wonderful. And George had said to us in 1988, I'm working with this company in New York City called Theater by the Blind, and we're doing a production of The Unexpected Guest, and he was starring in it. He's like, I would love if you guys would come to see it. So the summer of 1988, Nick and I came to New York. Now, mind you, I'm still in school. I'm like a sophomore in college, but we came to New York to see TBTB, Theater by the Blind, production of The Unexpected Guest starring George Achiotis and Lucia Puccia. She was the other actress, and that is the first time we saw anything to do with TBTB.
And so, when did you and Nick become more involved with TBTB?
I believe it was 1998. The artistic director at the time, Ike Shamblin, had asked us to. Well, the thing was, when they were Theater by the Blind, what they would do is they would bring sighted actors in to read plays for the blind and low vision actors. So that they could choose their season. So they would, have sighted actors, and that way it was easier than getting large print or braille scripts all the time just to make a decision. So we would read these plays to the blind, low vision actors, and then they would decide what productions they were going to do. We did not know at the time that that was Ike's way of auditioning actors, because it was always inclusive. Even as Theater by the Blind, they still included, they included sighted actors in the process.
So before you go on, didn't Ike found TBTB?
He did. In 1979, he used to work, I think he used to work for an ad agency. But he had his doctorate from Yale in directing, and he was approached to do a program at Lincoln Center, for I don't know if it was at the time if it was starring blind and low vision actors, or if it was a project for blind and low vision actors, like for an audience of blind and low vision. But anyway, Ike, I guess growing up, his grandmother was blind, and he used to go, he loved his grandmother, and he used to read to her, and they used to go to the movies together, and he would explain what was going on to her in the movies. And the year before, this is a little step into Ike's psyche back in the day. The year before, I guess the Oscar went to, gosh, what is the name of the movie starring Marlee Matlin?
Children of a lesser God.
Children of a lesser God. There you go. And he said, hey, if deaf people can win an award, why can't blind? So he started Theater by the Blind in 1979. I believe their first production didn't happen until 82, I think. And like I said, in 88, we went to, and it was an amazing production. I mean, it was stairs, like different levels, and everybody in the cast, I mean, I guess somebody was sighted, but I don't know who. And I just remember George, who was blind, and Lucia, who was also blind. I just remember him on the top level, and Lucia pulled out a cigarette, and he walked down with a lighter and lit her cigarette. And it just was like, wow. I was like, wow. And on the first try, I was just amazed at that. I was like, how did he do that? And I asked him, I was like, you're not blind. You've been lying to us. He was like, no. He's like, it's like, how did you do that? He's like, practice. A lot of practice.
So I was auditioning both you and Nick.
Yeah.
You two didn't know it at the time, which is very sneaky but brilliant of Ike.
He was very good at that.
So myself, not being in the room where it happened, what nod to Hamilton in case that wasn't obvious, what happened next?
He was doing a production that summer of like original plays or something, and we were in that. I don't remember the name of the play. I know that Pete Makochik wrote it, who, if anybody watches us now, he now goes by Peter Mark. But I remember that I was in a play for that. And then in 99, we did our first production with TVTV. We did a production of Vasa, which was a Russian play that Ike had paid someone to translate, and we were both in that. So yeah, that was our first production, was Vasa Vilezhnova.
And then when did you and Nick move up into management of TBTV?
Well, I did the first, I was kind of, I don't know that I did much for the next few years. I did a lot of readings, but I wasn't really in productions. Nick was in a lot of shows with TVTV. And in 2007, I was in a wheelchair, and I was actually cast in their production of Midsummer Night's Dream as Hermia, Titania, and one of the actor troupe, but I don't remember which, which was amazing. And the thing was, Ike had been trying to get a big grant, and the person who was the head of this grant had come to see it, and we actually got a great review in the New York Times. And there was a picture of me in the wheelchair and George, who was blind, and she said, use that picture and that review, and we got this grant. So then we ended up, yeah, I don't really, it kind of just happened somehow.
We're talking about so many timelines.
Yeah, it's just such a long time. Yeah. Then we ended up changing the name. And Nick and I were big on that.
When was that, by the way?
I believe that was somewhere between 2007 and 2008. And the whole point was we wanted to keep the moniker TBTB because that's what we all called it anyhow. Nobody wanted to, nobody wanted to say theater by the blind. So we just said TBTB constantly. And Nick and I came up with the theater breaking through barriers. I know that. Because I remember the day we were just going, we were just like TBTB, TBTB, TBTB. What does TBTB mean? And so I remember that. And the whole purpose was, obviously, I'm in a wheelchair and I just did a show with them. So it's not that we were not inclusive, but the name Theater by the Blind made it feel exclusive, like you had to be blind or low vision. And it was never, it was always an inclusive company, but no one really, you know, nobody, if you had someone in a wheelchair or you had someone that, you know, was a congenital amputee or an amputee or someone who used crutches, or they're not going to automatically go, oh, let me audition for Theater by the Blind. Because it was just, and we had mentioned that to Ike, and it's like, you know, it's.
From what I'm remembering that Nick told me, in actually one of our first meetings, we were driving in his car down to Union Square or somewhere for some reason. And I think he said he took over from Ike in 2015.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But we had both been, you know, I had become a stage manager, and I did, we had already been doing little things administratively, just little, I mean, nothing to write, Nick more than anyone. Nick was starting to write grants and do things like that. But yeah, so Ike became ill. He developed cancer, and that happened earlier, and he was okay, but then it came back. And yeah, so in 2015, 14 or 15, 14, 2014, it came, that was our very first trip to Japan. And Ike was supposed to go, and his wife, and Ike, the cancer had come back. And he's like, I can't do it. So we went to Japan, and Nick was in charge of everyone in Japan. And we came back, and Nick was like, I'm going to go down to see Ike. You know, basically to tell him everything that happened, to give him a report. And Ike stopped him and was just like, you're going to have to take over. Yeah. Which was bizarre. And we had already cast the next show that we were in, and it was, they were reviving the unexpected guest. And Nick was the Nick was the lead. He was the male lead. I was Benny in it, and Ike was gonna direct it, and he just got very sick very quick. And he needed someone, and I knew a friend of Ike's because we've been working there for so long. And I was like, well, what about, I'm so sorry, my phone is ringing here. I'm sorry about that. And
things happen.
Yeah, so I, you know, I'd mentioned a friend of his, and he was like, oh, that's a great idea. And she took over. I thought she was going to help. We thought she was going to be like an assistant director to him, and he just couldn't do it. And then by, I think he died early February of the following year, like right before our production. And Nick was now not only the lead, but he was the producer. So, yeah. And that, yeah. So that was a, that he kind of, and the thing was, he kind of had to learn everything by fire, like, because Ike was very ill and didn't really have time to show him a lot of things before he went. Yeah. So it was kind of a learning while you're doing type thing.
It's very interesting. And sorry, lost my train of thought for a second. Very poetic in a sense that it, the production was a revival of the first production
that we ever saw.
Yet, which it's just perfect in a way. Nick is so full. Pardon me for gushing about your husband on this.
Gush away.
Interview, Nick is just so full of life and creative sparks and energy. How is it being around that energy as a fellow audience? I don't want to get too personal, but as a fellow audience, how is it?
It's amazing. It is. He's a spark, and the ideas that he comes up with are just mind-boggling. I'm like, where did that come from? He's like, oh, I was in the shower, you know?
I mean, every time we do a hybrid or a virtual intensive, he leads off every production with just this bombastic creative energy. And the point I'm trying to make is that's not an act. That's not forced at all. That's not him just performing for the camera.
No.
That literally is who Nick Vercelli is in real life.
Yeah, exactly. He believes in the mission of this company wholeheartedly. And people, you know, the thing is, people are like, oh, well, he's a straight white non-disabled man. Why is he heading this company? And it's like, because no one else could do it. Not like him. Nick has been around disability his entire life. You know, growing up, he'd had a neighbor with Down syndrome that was like always, it was at their house every day. He used to go with his father on the weekends. His father used to help the blind. He used to go shopping with them or whatever, and Nick would go with them. He had two siblings that had medical issues. He has a wife with MS who is in a wheelchair. His heart is so into this company that it's I can't imagine this company with anybody else at the helm.
Neither can I. He just steers the ship in such a way that I think who I never met, would be so ecstatic
Oh,
And
absolutely.
he ceded the company control to the. There is no one I could have ceded creative control of the company at that time or any time, and
No,
I'm
and I
just
think he, yeah.
riffing off things that I have no idea about, but that he knew that the company that he founded was going to be just fine without him, as long as Nick Vercelli, his protege, whether Nick knew that at the time or not, but
Right.
given that I auditioned both you and Nick without you two knowing, which is again brilliant, by the way. Yeah, it's just a professional match made in heaven.
Yeah.
And
And
so,
he
yeah.
worked, I mean, Nick works so hard. He's the only full-time employee of the company still. So we're still very small. And he likes to say it, and he's right. We're the best kept secret on off Broadway in New York.
Absolutely. I would say, I would go a step further and say the best kept secret of New York City itself, creatively and otherwise. But
Yeah.
you were an actor before you became disabled. We've already talked about the adaptation of living with MS. How was it first returning to acting with MS?
It was really hard. I mean, obviously I work with TV, but I mean, I was auditioning for other things, and even a little bit to this day, you come in a wheelchair, you might as well not show up. Even Ike, I mean, when I did Midsummer with Ike, he was very reluctant to put me on stage initially. It was Pamela Sabah, who was not in the production. She wasn't going to be in the production, but she's been with the company a little slightly longer than us, by like a couple months. And Nick, well, not so much Nick, because he didn't want to seem prejudiced, so to speak. But Pamela really pushed Ike to put me in it. And yeah, I mean, he got the grant, he changed the name, he did everything. So, because he was like, what am I going to do with that chair? It's like another character. But we thought about it, and we were like, well, Hermia is the small one, so I'm automatically smaller than any other actress he's going to cast, because I'm seated. So that already, and the whole minimus small blah blah blah, where they start picking on her, it's like, it's so much more when you've got her in a wheelchair. It's like, oh, that's really mean, kind of thing. And Titania is the fairy queen, so she was riding in her chariot. So we made it work, and the fact that we made it work really was amazing. But getting acting was really hard. It still is. It's very hard in the chair.
How is directing? Because you're also a director.
Directing in a chair is fine. It's app, you know, it, cause I don't, you know, I just have to be there and tell other people what to do. And I like it. And I like telling other people what to do. I didn't even start directing until 2015 or something like that. I think that was the first time I directed anything. And yeah, I mean, I could do that. And I told Nick, and this is, you know, I'm saying this online and I probably shouldn't. Because somebody might hold me to it, because I'm not sure I'm really capable. But I told Nick for the next intensive, I said, maybe I want to write. So I don't know about that. We'll see. Maybe I'll be a writer too.
So in case there are any advocates or actors listening or watching this episode who are just making their way into the professional world, what would be some action tips you would give them?
Acting tips?
Acting tips or professional advocacy tips?
You know, you just, I never, and to this day, I mean, now it's been 10, 17 years since I'm in a wheelchair. But I still don't like to admit that I'm disabled, which is why I said wheelchair user. It's like, I use a wheelchair, but that doesn't make me disabled, does it? It kind of does, but.
That's a topic for a whole number episodes. You opened yourself up to that.
Okay. Continue. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, you just have to bring you and everyone, every person is special. And there is no other you. So, as long as you bring you to the table, then that's what people are seeing. They're not going to, like, even like with the wheelchair. Yes. Audiences in general will be like, oh, a wheelchair. But if you embody your part, if 5 minutes into the show, they're not going to see whatever, a wheelchair, a walker, a cane, a crutch, whatever, they're gonna see the character. They're not gonna see anything else. So you just have to get through that first 5 minutes of knowing. I mean, when I did The Unexpected Guest, and it happened a few times, people would come up to me after the show and ask me why I didn't stand up for the curtain call. To which I answered, oh, my gosh, you know, I have to do that, don't I? Because they just assumed that it was part of the play. And that is the ultimate compliment as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what I mean, just, you know, my only advice is to be true to yourself.
So we've talked about a lot in this episode.
I know, there's just such a time.
Yeah, timelines and other words, really the history of TBTB Theater Breaking Through Barriers and the Utah Shakespeare Festival where everyone met. There's a lot in this episode, and I'd like to think that both advocates with disabilities and people who have yet to discover and embrace their own disabilities listen to this podcast, but I'm not naive enough to think that both groups take exactly the same things away from each episode. So as my guests, what do you hope that advocates with disabilities take away from this episode? And what do you hope that people who have yet to embrace their own disabilities take away from this episode?
Yeah, again, I know, obviously, I know more than anything, I know a lot of people with MS, and I'm just going to stick to that because that's what I know. I know a lot of blind people from, obviously, I know a lot of people with various disabilities, and I know a lot of the people that I know are, they don't feel comfortable doing things. They don't feel comfortable going out. And they're always like, wow, how do you do it? How do you do it? And it's like, you just do it. You just get out there. You can't, there is no reason for anyone with a disability to hide. There's no reason. The world is not perfect. Far from it, right? But again, why? You just have to get out there. You just have to be part of life. You have to enjoy yourself. There are things you can do. Go to a movie, for goodness sake. Go out to dinner. Everywhere is not accessible, but there's enough places that are, that you can enjoy life. You just have to enjoy your life.
I remember telling Nick at the first virtual intensive that your acting ability, which just made me bring my own AAA game, was terrifyingly brilliant, which it absolutely was. What do you hope? And so that's the lead from the top. So what do you hope that people without disabilities or who have yet to discover their own disabilities take away from this episode and from acting with a disability or observing actors with disabilities in general?
Okay. Again, I've been in a wheelchair a long time, and it was different. Not a lot different, but there have been advances. There are, actors on Broadway with disabilities. And I think it's more acceptable to have a disability and be an actor at this point. I don't think it, my issue is, generally, they use people with disabilities to play people with disabilities. And I think what I would like is actors with disabilities to be considered for any role, because we do exist in life. I think everyone knows someone that has a disability or know someone who knows someone, so I don't see why it's such a scary thing anymore. And I would just like, as far as acting goes, I would like the powers that be to see the talent rather than see the disability, which is a huge thing. As far as just regular people, I if you took all of the disabled people in the world and you put them in one country, they had their own country, it would be the third largest country on the planet. So obviously, only surpassed by China and India, and not by much. So we're there. So we're just people, we're just people just like you. That's what I would hope people without disabilities or people who have not come onto their disability. And the thing is, people are living older. People are living longer lives, and the potential of becoming disabled in some way is really high. So, just people are people. That's all I want. That's all
Yeah.
I want people to see.
And so if you've made it that far in the episode to loop back the timeline in my debut acting job with Theater Breaking Through Barriers, I played opposite Anne-Marie Morelli, who played a mob boss, and she wrought so much menacing embodiment, passion, that I told her husband years later on camera that I still remember that debut production, and that you are rightfully so in that production, terrifyingly brilliant. And so thank you very much, my friend, for everything you've shared in this episode and for everything that you, Nick and Richard, we cannot forget Richard, do for Theater Breaking Through Barriers and for the disability community in general.
Thank you so much, Keith. I appreciate it.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guests, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on our social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, and share the podcast. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2024.